This is my bro Joker from the island.
And this is Rafterman.
Rafterman. They're from Stars and Stripes. They'll make you famous.
Okay.
We're the Lust Hawk Squad. We're life takers and heartbreakers. Yeah. We shoot them full of holes and fill them full of lead.
You a photographer?
No, I'm a combat correspondent.
Oh, you seen much combat?
Well, I've seen a little on TV.
You're a real comedian.
Well, they call me the Joker.
Well, I got a joke for you. I'm gonna tear you a new asshole.
Well, Pilgrim, only after you eat the peanuts out of my shit.
You talk the talk. Do you walk the walk?
You might not believe it, but under fire, Animal Mother's one of the finest human beings in the world. All he needs is somebody to throw hand grenades at him the rest of his life.
Roger, come on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. I am Jim, and now, the star of Netflix's latest binging sensation, making a podcaster, the bastard son of a thousand maniacs, Teal. How's it going, buddy? Happy 2019.
Oh, wow, it's a new year already. I guess we got to look forward to, more movies in this year.
No, hold on. There seems to be, in the news, an absence of a certain ornithological piece. A headline regarding mass awareness of a certain avian variety.
Really?
Have you not heard? It was my understanding that everyone had heard.
I don't think I'd heard.
Well, it's about the bird! Bird's the word. Bird is the word. Don't you know about the bird? Well, Jimmy's going to tell you about the bird. I said a bird box.
Oh.
It's the latest sensation according to Netflix.
It's the latest sensation according to social media.
Listen. We're going to have to just, before we even talk about this film, which I'm going to guess you've seen.
I've seen Bird Box. I've seen it 14 times.
Yeah, okay. So you're 14 of the 45 million accounts.
Are me, yes.
Listen, this since that headline came out, it's bothered me. And it also, what it did was it got me to watch a show that I really wasn't planning on watching. Yeah. And this is the whole problem I have with Netflix. I don't buy it. They never give any information about how their shows are doing. And then, you know, once a year they've got a big budget movie they've spent a lot on and they're looking for subscribers, right?
Yeah, it's all about.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's all about getting subscribers. It's all about promoting a piece of content that will get somebody to subscribe. And Bird Box is effective in the sense that it's such a social media thing that people feel like they have to see it.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I don't believe there are any laws against Netflix making a claim that 45 million accounts watch this movie.
I think they can make any claim they want. I don't... I don't even think that would be false advertising.
Right. And there's no way for anybody to verify it. So they can say that. But that doesn't make it true. Because think about this. All right? This is a very easy math.
Yeah.
45 million accounts. And let's just say, according to Netflix, they are only counting those accounts that watched at least 70% of the movie.
Right.
Now, let's, you know, okay, there could be like one person watching, but there could be more. But I'm going to just average it out without any, you know, because, hey, if Netflix can make it up, so can I. let's say two people per account have watched this movie in that first week. That's 90 million. So now we're at Super Bowl numbers.
Yes.
And for a movie that is like a B/C grade film at best.
Okay, but here's the thing. Everybody has Netflix.
Okay, a lot of people do.
Yeah, everybody has Netflix, and they promoted this movie. Like, when I went to the main page on Netflix, this is what was there for a week. And it would start auto-playing, too.
Yeah, okay, but without any type of verification and them never releasing things so we get a sort of a benchmark as to how other shows like this perform on there, I don't buy it because they're trying to tell me that in 1 week, 90 million people watch this thing. And if you added a ticket price to that.
Oh, I know.
That's like we're talking 900 million. There's no way that this movie, I don't care if it's.
Well, that would make it like one of the most successful movies in years.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And sure, a lot of people have seen it, but there's just no way. I'm calling no on this. I feel that I'm being deceived. And it worked, right? Because I guarantee you, if there wasn't all this hype and the 45 million, my curiosity wouldn't have been piqued.
Oh, I only decided to watch this because of the social media. And I was seeing all these posts from people who loved it and people who hated it. And I just needed to know what was going on for myself. Otherwise, I never would have watched this movie. I didn't care.
What people did you see that said they liked this movie? I'm calling you out. I don't believe it. I think it's as artificial as these 45 million accounts. I don't believe that there are throngs of people that you know that saw this movie and loved it.
Oh, I'm not saying they loved it. Okay, I'll give you an example of a post I saw.
Okay.
It said, it's okay not to like Bird Box. It's not okay to belittle people for not liking Bird Box.
Was this a millennial?
Yes, but I'm not saying everybody loved it. I'm saying people were watching it like crazy.
I love that, though. This is like a preemptive strike post where someone basically is saying, I liked it. Please don't hate me for liking Bird Box. I don't really have a wide-ranging opinion of movies, and this is like the greatest thriller I've ever seen because I didn't see the John Krasinski film that came out just 7 months ago, A Quiet Place, which was almost the same film. Not quite, but almost.
Well, they're very similar. They have a similar premise and, to a large extent, a similar execution, which is people trapped in a house.
So here's the thing. Yeah, and the house trap thing, and it's funny. I did see a post somewhere today that it was a friend of mine. They were responding to another, you know, Bird Box post. And
yeah.
By the way, this is going to be a spoiler edition. I'm not going to hold back on anything we're talking about. So if we're going to talk about Bird Box, there's going to be spoilers. So
oh, yeah.
If you don't want to know any of the spoilers of Bird Box, if you weren't one of the 45 million or the 100 million since that first week that have probably seen it, then, you know, skip ahead to some other show episode or part. But
yeah, because we are going to ruin Bird Box.
Well, I mean,
by giving away the ending.
We have to talk about the whole thing because it does borrow from like 1,000 films. And the whole in the house thing is basically your classic group of people in a zombie apocalypse.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The only
difference being that they can't look out the windows. But it's
except for the windows are so well lit.
I know. Okay, let's. Oh boy.
All right. So I'm going to tell you what.
Let's go for the big things first.
No. I want you because, you know, we have been accused by some of our loyal listeners that sometimes we talk about a film and we don't kind of give any sort of quick synopsis of what the hell
okay,
is
okay, I'll give a
about.
Quick so synopsis.
I don't really want to talk about it.
I'll give the quick synopsis.
So you give the synopsis.
Okay, so demons come to Earth, and if you are a good person and you look at the demons, you will kill yourself. If you're a bad person and you look at the demons, you will stay alive and run around trying to get other people to look at the demons. So these demons exist, and we focus on a group of people who have shut themselves in a house and blocked out the windows so they don't see the demons, because the demons can't go indoors. And so it's Sandra Bullock and John Malkovich and a couple other people, and they're in a house trying to survive, and eventually they have to leave the house, and everything goes wrong, and people get picked. It's a horror movie, so people get picked off one after the other. And finally, Sandra Bullock escapes, and at the end of the movie, meets some blind people, and all blind people are good, according to the movie. There's no such thing as a bad blind person.
That would be called blind box instead of
brown. That would be called blind box. But and so
I think
yeah.
you're being a little bit cynical and sort of simplistic in the description, but I get what you're saying.
Okay, yes. No, I am being cynical and simplistic in the description. You're right. I think the movie is ultimately silly because of this black and white morality that it has.
Now, let's take a step back. Here's the thing, and it's full disclosure. This type of film story, it's not necessarily my favorite genre. So, you know, I guess if you do like these types of films, you're going to go into them. And I'll use my wife as an example. She's very good. If she likes the genre,
yeah.
she will put aside some of the silliness or the tropes
yeah.
or the plot holes, because she just wants to be entertained. And I think
absolutely.
That's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. And I do like the genre. I'm a big fan of bottle movies, which this isn't entirely, but sections of it are. I like the genre. There were a lot of things I liked about Bird Box, but ultimately I felt like it was a cop-out.
I will agree wholeheartedly, but I want to take a step back to explain some of the reasons why, even though this isn't my favorite genre, I'm in it, I'm watching it, but why did I still not like the film?
Right.
I didn't read the book. It's based on a book, so I have no idea how well it follows or doesn't follow.
Yeah, I have no idea.
And so it's hard for me, you know, I could be picking apart a plot line that I really should be picking apart the book for, but let's
right.
just say that I feel this story is on very similar grounds to another story that has its roots from a short story and
uh-huh.
that was made into a film. It's called The Mist.
Yes, it is very similar to The Mist.
And at some point, I felt it was so similar to The Mist that I felt like, geez, all they need to do now is get themselves sort of holed up in a supermarket. And lo and behold, no sooner do I say that, than they all go down to the supermarket. And I thought for sure they were going to get holed up there for the entire film, but they don't. But there is
no,
that,
it's just a few minutes.
There is that one character, and I don't remember the actor's name. He's on TV now on a show, and he was in Get Out.
Yeah.
And he was like the best buddy, the sort
yeah.
of the comic relief. And he's kind of the comic relief here, but he seems to be well-versed in all sorts of mystical good versus evil.
Because he's writing
jungle.
A novel, so he's done a lot of reading about demons.
And so there's, again, where I started to feel that Mist connection.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I guess, you know, if I was to give credit to the film that cost, didn't it cost like $30 million to make this?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't even.
I think it cost like $30 million. I don't know. Maybe it was all for Sandra Bullock's salary or something. But you'd think for $30 million, you'd get to see the creatures. For
well,
more than a
second. Okay. But you can't see the creatures because of the premise of the movie.
I guess.
I don't think the audience can see what the creatures look like without ruining the conceit of the movie.
What are we supposed to turn to evil and kill ourselves if we do?
Yes.
Then it sounds like it's a Japanese horror film.
Well, yeah, it does. But I think that that's a little bit, I think that's why we didn't see the creatures.
By the way, I'm going to interrupt. Have you ever seen the Japanese film Suicide Club?
No.
Oh, it's a much better film where people randomly are just suddenly deciding to commit suicide. I'm sorry, I interrupted your thing. Yeah, I just thought of movies about everybody committing mass suicide. That's way better than Bird Box.
Yes, it's way, yeah. So I don't think, that's what I was going to say, is that there's that really stupid thing with the one character who's done a bunch of drawings of the demons and lays them out for everybody to see that he's evil and can look at the demons. That's the most look we get at them.
I feel like we saw like a shadow of them or something in a reflection at some point in the movie too.
Oh, I don't remember that.
I don't know. You know, that's so funny. As a movie like that, I mean, I have to say I was kind of, you know, my attention was diverted, which is, again, this is another problem. And maybe we're going to be getting into this discussion throughout this episode, but it's the idea of a movie. Is it a theatrical film? Or right. Does it have that theatrical film feel?
Does it feel like a movie? So right after watching Bird Box, I hadn't seen A Quiet Place, so I decided I needed to watch it. And it is cinematic, A Quiet Place. I had issues with it, sort of a little suspension of disbelief issues here and there, but this was one of those things where I like the genre, I like the movie, I got caught up in it. It was cinematic and effective at building tension, and that was enough for me to forgive those little nitpicks.
Well, one of the things, and I think it's a very important differentiator, and I get it. Like, I think a lot of this all boils down dollars and cents and the producers.
Yes.
And all producers want to save money somewhere. So it, almost like, you know, 99.999% of producers are going to want the film shot digitally and
yes,
not on
film. Yes, of course. Yes.
And you have to fight very hard and make a lot of justifications if you're a director for shooting film.
Yes.
And that also is a talent, right? The director has to tell you why the story is going to be better. And John Krasinski, to his credit as a director,
made that argument.
Right? He made that argument. The film is actually a film. It is shot on film, not digitally. And I knew it right away. I said to myself,
yeah,
look at the look of the trees and the landscape. Yeah. There's a softness
and
to
a
the
richness.
Light.
And
a richness,
depth. Yeah.
That, and then when the camera moves, and again, this is something that most people, I know they don't pick it up, especially today if you're used to seeing digital films, but
right,
when camera moves that's actually being recorded on film versus camera movements that are being recorded digitally, they look different.
They do look different, yeah. Well, okay, here's another thing that I think is going on here, though, is that A Quiet Place is on rails or on sticks. There's very little Steadicam in the movie. There's some. But a movie like Bird Box, everything is Steadicam.
Yes, it looks very robotic.
Yeah, well, and it just looks, not a lot of thought is put into the shots.
Well, here's the thing, and you know, you said this to me offline, and it is that big conundrum. When you watch a film like Bird Box, it's shot like 2:3:9, so it's got,
yeah,
this like super widescreen aspect ratio that you say, well, this was meant for a theater, except that in Netflix world, it's not.
Right.
And it's being shot digitally, which makes sense, I guess, if it's on Netflix. It has this very high definition look.
Yes.
And then it's got the Steadicam use, these very, very fluid shots. It kind of leads the film to be a kind of cold, lifeless. And also, I find that interiors shot this way,
yeah,
tend to look like they're on a set.
They absolutely look like they're on a set, yeah.
And so now I feel like I'm watching a TV movie and not a theatrical film.
Yeah, I feel like I'm watching actors on a set, which feels like TV.
Yeah, and you know, and I mean, I don't want to keep picking on this film, but
I do.
But I am.
I do.
But Sandra Bullock is like walking around like a zombie in this film. She has no personality whatsoever in this movie.
No, Malkovich is the one character who stands out.
Yeah, he kind of says, "Hey, I'm getting a paycheck, and they want me to do the Malkovich thing.
I'm gonna
do it.
I'm gonna do the Malkovich thing," and he does the Malkovich thing. But he has a personality.
And the middle of the film does kind of keep your interest because you've got multiple characters. There's some dynamic. There's some interesting,
yeah,
things going on. And this is where the film, if I was to say it's successful at all, it's the middle portion.
It absolutely is the middle portion. And one thing that this made me think of is a term, I don't know if I've heard this before, but situational horror. Sort of like situational comedy, but with horror. And I think the middle portion of that film does that, where it's sort of like, okay, you got the guy locked in the garage, you got the guy who's got knocked out, you got the guy who's evil, you got the people giving birth, and it's sort of all going on at the same time in this house with these different elements working at the same time, and it's the situation that creates the fear.
I don't think you found it, but I didn't find this movie remotely scary, no tension. I just kind of watched it.
There was one scene that I found tension in, but
what was that?
It was.
You don't have to go into full detail. I don't quite understand where there could have even been a moment.
It was the birth scene and right after the birth scene.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that also follows into the situational tension, and I think that when we talk about birth scenes, even though I think it was over the top and ridiculous, John Krasinski created amazing tension.
I totally agree.
Like where you get two birth, you know, that's why I said two very similar films. You should almost watch them back to back because
I did.
I know you did, but I guess for those out there listening to the episode, if you haven't seen A Quiet Place, great double bill, because you're going to see very similar stories handled differently. But one was somebody that really, I think, knew what they were doing, and another person who didn't. And there was a lot of things that made A Quiet Place more interesting. One,
yes,
the event had already taken place.
Right.
And so one's kind of telling you the beginning of an event. The other one kind of gets you sort of, it's almost like the middle, if you think about it. And the ending of the film is really getting ready for the next act.
Right. That was a disappointment for me for A Quiet Place.
I know, but let's face it. Would you rather have that as a sequel possibility or one of those classic moments where everybody looks like everything's fine, and then somebody turns to the camera and some weird CGI like phantom comes jumping out, and then the end credits?
Okay, I don't want that either.
Exactly.
But you can't win
with those movies. They're always going to set up a sequel.
I thought the creatures were really cool in A Quiet Place, and I'm glad they showed them. After watching Bird Box, I was afraid that Quiet Place was going to be an artsy horror film where you don't see the creatures.
Nope, you see the creatures.
Yes, and that made me really happy.
Do we want to talk about that ending of a Bird Box? Because I think that's where we get into a little of the M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong.
Why don't you? What was your thought on the ending?
Well, I mean, I really wasn't fully focused on the film, and it didn't capture my interest to know, I wonder what's going to happen. Basically, and it jumps back and forth in time, that Sandra Bullock's character, she has these two kids with, there's a little bit of mystery as to who these kids are going to end up being, and how does she have them. And so that's why they do the back and forth framing device, which I don't think that was necessary.
I don't think it was necessary either. I would have preferred
been much more. Yeah, a linear story would have been more interesting.
Yes, because what's going on in the river is actually not that interesting, and it's just episodic.
No, it could have been a nice conclusion. As a matter of fact, I think the end of the movie might have had a better payoff if it all was in linear fashion, and you didn't have really too much time to think about who's on the other end calling her.
Yeah.
So essentially, some voice that could be friendly, could not, and that's the whole idea, is that you really don't know if there's another survivor out there, are they a good person? Are they a bad person?
Right.
So she makes this journey. She gets to the end of the rainbow, and it turns out there's a whole community of survivors. And here's the spoiler for those who don't want to know, turn off now, is it's a school for the blind.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why they're all safe, because they're blind.
Because they're blind. But they're not even all blind. There's a lot of sighted people in there, too.
Well, they found their way.
Who've shown up, yeah.
Right, right. Like that doctor from the beginning of the.
Exactly.
So, you know, I guess, I don't know. For those who just love, are easily surprised by things, I didn't necessarily see the ending coming. Ha ha. But But I really wasn't looking for it. I was sort of like, oh, let's just see what happens. It's either going to be one of those finales where, like, you know, there's like a twist and it's bad.
Right.
Or whatever. So I really wasn't thinking, oh, wait a minute. You know, hey, we know they should, if they don't want to get killed by these things, they should just blind each other. That might have made another interesting ending where, in order to save herself and the kids, she decides to
blind them. Yeah.
And then only to then get rescued. Because, of course, like that's like the great genius of the
end of the Mist.
Film The Mist. You
yes.
know? That was a real ballsy ending. But, you know, Netflix plays it safe. And now they've got a movie that is a Netflix movie that people are actually watching.
Yes.
Because let's face it, I have seen enough of their Netflix movie crap to kind of have a brand that's like, oh, Netflix movie?
It feels like a brand, and they feel similar. They feel there's almost something similar in the production and the cinematography.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. Here's the thing, right? I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. I see everything.
Yeah.
And when a movie of theirs comes out in the theater, I'm racing to see it.
Yeah.
And I'm upset if my local, you know,
theater doesn't
have it. So you'd think their newest film, The Ballad of Lester Scruggs or whatever, I would be seeing it opening weekend, right? But it's on Netflix. And suddenly, something about it being on Netflix, it just lowered my interest level. And I still haven't seen it yet.
That's why I haven't watched it, too.
I'm going to get there, and I'm sure I'm going to enjoy it. But something about it tells me that, wow. It's
not quite a real movie.
Yeah, and I think that's a problem that Netflix does. Obviously, when they're touting 45 million accounts, they don't care. And I think that's frustrating as a film lover.
Exactly.
That they really don't care.
They really don't care.
You know, Amazon Prime, at least I'll give them credit there, Amazon Studios, they'll put those out in the theater, and it will be several months before they'll put it onto their service.
Yeah, they're actually treating them like movies.
And I may not catch one of those films in the theater and not see it until it's on Prime, but I can't tell you what the difference is. But I think of those as actual films versus what I see on Netflix most of the time.
Yeah, and it's not just that they had a theatrical release. There's something actually off about it. Did you see War Machine with Brad Pitt? That was a very expensive Netflix movie.
No. And was it designed just to be on Netflix?
I don't know. I don't know the history of it, but I think it was designed just to be on Netflix.
I did not see the film.
And it could have been really good, but it just doesn't feel like a movie. It feels like a TV show.
And that's the problem I think maybe Netflix has to solve. And I think they are trying to solve it, right? So they've got, you know, the Irishman, the big Martin Scorsese film.
Right.
That's going to come on end of next year. Or end of this year, I should say.
Yeah.
It's been delayed for a long time. That always kind of raises red flags. Is it delayed because it's terrible? Or is it delayed, as they said, because they are working on all of these special effects for de-aging?
Right.
Which also concerns me and how good that's going to look. But,
right.
But there's a film where, you know, my preference would be to see a Martin Scorsese film in the theaters.
Yes.
Especially one of his gangster type films, because that's just the experience. I like the big screen experience.
Yes.
So I think they will do some form of a release. And then, you know, the only other example of a film that they've released that they've done a theatrical release, and I think for an art film, they've actually done not a bad job of it, is Roma, which I did watch opening night on Netflix.
And
because I really wanted to see it.
Does it feel like a real movie?
It does.
Yeah.
Well, you're in the hands of a
of a real director.
Master.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it also, it's a foreign film that, if you think about it, it was not going to be a 1,000, 2,000 screen release.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's already a smaller type of film.
And what they're doing with it, which I think is kind of interesting, I'm hoping I can get there to see it, is they have been doing a 70mm film
release.
That's
right. That's right.
And that's interesting because the film was shot on the Alexa 65, which it's interesting because in the digital world, 65 doesn't necessarily mean anything. I guess it's just like a higher data rate.
Okay, right.
It's not like a 65mm film. But,
right.
I mean, I've seen a couple of movies that have been shot with the Alexa 65, like The Revenant. And
right.
They're amazing looking.
Yeah, The Revenant looks great.
So from a pure film lover standpoint, I'd be very fascinated to see how do you take the 65 millimeter digital files,
right,
and then you transfer it to
70.
It's actually 65 millimeter film. Right. How does that look? So do you get that same, you know, sharp details? I know there are people out there, their preference, they got a big screen TV, a 65, inch TV at home.
Right.
And if I don't know, I don't have the high definition for the 4K for Netflix, but
right,
I'm assuming that it's on 4K for Netflix. And so the question is that good enough, or do you get a bump from the big screen? I don't know, but I am kind of curious. I think the movie's worth seeing multiple times.
I think you get a bump from the big screen. I mean, I have a big screen at home, and I have Netflix HD or whatever it is, Ultra. And
so when you saw Bird Box, was that like the 4K?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, it looks great. But then, you know, I went to the theater and saw Mary Poppins a few days ago, and it's just so much sharper. There's just so much more detail and sharpness at the theater. They have files. The bit rate on their files is so much higher than what you're getting through streaming or even from a Blu-ray.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. Again, studios don't seem to care. I mean, Netflix doesn't care about the theaters, but I think that with this digital revolution, the industry made a mistake. And that's because with the TVs today, most people, and you know, there's a lot of reasons why going to the theater is a headache these days, but there used to be a difference. You knew when you were seeing a 35 millimeter film in a theater, you knew that no matter what, you could not get that same experience at home.
Exactly.
You get varying degrees of quality depending on your system and your TV, but film was film, and it just never is going to look the same.
Yeah.
But when you see these films on digital, I will say, yeah, there's still a difference. But for movies that may not be, like, you know, higher on your list, even myself, well, I can see that at home.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, and just, there, you know, I don't get a chance to get out to the theater as much as I want because I have kids. And so I end up seeing a lot of stuff at home.
Yeah, and it's great that we have, you know, these big screen TVs and things just so we can see things at pretty great quality.
Yeah.
Compared to the VCR days.
Exactly. I mean, I definitely saw a lot of panned and scanned movies on a 20-inch screen in my youth. And that's just not happening anymore. Everything's letterboxed now. And the quality is so much higher.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but here's a great example, and I know you didn't get a chance to see this film, but I'll mention it because I think they're going to do a release in a couple of months because it was so popular, is the Peter Jackson did that documentary,
yes,
They Shall Not Grow Old.
Yes.
And it had a very interesting release strategy here in the United States where there were 2 days in December, one that was about a week before Christmas and then one a couple days after. And there's that... I don't know much about them, but there's the Fathom events.
Okay.
Yeah, there's like this. They're like this mystery like cinema organization that they put on like operas and other like film classics. And
oh, I don't know about this. This sounds interesting.
You're joking with me, right?
No,
you're joking. You're just playing.
Yes.
Yeah, he knows about Fathom events. People out there, don't let Mr. Teal fool you. He knows about the Fathom events. He knows. We all know about the Fathom events. So I myself have never been lured to the theater of the Fathom events, but found out that they were the only game in town that was going to be showing this documentary. And I heard about it, you know, from word of mouth that, this is going to be this incredible World War I documentary that Peter Jackson got a hold of all this footage and then restored it. But then I saw the trailer online and my mouth kind of dropped and I said, my God, this looks amazing. So I was away over the holidays, but where I was, my mother-in-law was gracious enough to secure tickets for my wife and I, my oldest, to go to the theater a couple days after Christmas
nice.
And see this film. And it's, you know, the documentary itself is about an hour and a half. There's about a 20-minute documentary after the documentary that talks about how they put it together.
Oh, interesting.
But what Peter Jackson decided to do is, you know, he's a World War I buff, and he had relatives that were in World War I, and he had actually a lot of memorabilia and costumes uniforms and other things.
Right.
So this was like really up his alley, but he felt that he had seen footage, the same footage, over and over again over the years, and what did he need to do to make it fresh?
Right.
So they restored the footage to, you know, cleaned it up,
right,
and also figured out exactly what the speeds should be.
Oh.
So that it would have kind of what the people might really look in motion.
Right, right, right.
So now you're already seeing this footage.
Did they put in extra frames or something to?
I don't know how that works.
Okay.
I'm not that, you know, but through computers, and it's not like perfect motion, but certainly.
Sure.
Compared to the way you'd watch footage of this nature in the past.
Right, with hand-cranked cameras. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the first step. The second step is, they did amazing research on the footage itself and where these things might have gone.
Right.
They decided that the narrative they would go for is that with World War I, you can't encompass the entire war. So they're going to focus just on the Western Front.
Okay.
And kind of take you through what was that experience like to be in the trenches.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, sometimes you see a World War I segment of a movie or something, and they always try to focus on the trenches. You know it's bad, etc. So now you've got a narrative. They put in sound effects, very detailed, and they had voice actors.
Oh, that wow.
So they had a couple of things. They had archival audio from actual soldiers in World War I, and all the narration was done by them.
Oh, wow.
And then, which is amazing, is other voice actors hired expert lip readers to see what the soldiers were saying. And then they had that audio recorded by people that were from the exact area that these particular soldiers would have been from.
Wow.
And then there was a speech, and it was amazing. I didn't know about this until after the documentary was over, when Peter Jackson was talking in the follow-up, that there was a famous speech. He had seen the footage dozens of times, and they were able to track down through all of their, like, sleuthing and sharpening of images. They were able to figure out exactly what that speech was, match it up with the lips, and then have that audio recorded so you could watch this and look like the captain was actually...
That is really cool.
It's amazing. So now, add to that very intense colorization work to try to get very accurate colors,
right,
to the degree they could, of what the actual uniforms and the settings. You throw that, and then on top of that, he had it in 3D. So now, when you're watching...
Wait, it's in 3D?
It's in 3D! So when you get through, when you're first watching it, it's in black and white. And it's for about 20 minutes, and it kind of leads you up to the setting of, like, what happens, how do you get to World War I, and the training, etc. But you're seeing it in 3D, and it looks almost like you're looking in a ViewMaster, and you're getting sort of...
Right, like with those layers, the planes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting this movie box sort of depth. Nothing flashy or whatever, but you're watching it. Then, suddenly, when they've hit the battlefield, it goes into color, and... What you're seeing for the first time, when you see trenches, the depth, you suddenly see details that you were not able to see in any other footage. And there's a scene where they show the trenches and a battle is getting ready to start. And you can see in the distance, you can actually see where the city line is. And now you, for the first time, can see, wow, look at how little room there was between one trench of the Allies versus the enemies. And you're starting to just get a real sense of what it really looked like there.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, they went to the degree of going back to the battlefields and looking at the colors of the surroundings so they could even get that stuff right.
Okay. So this really is a Peter Jackson movie.
It is, and it's him doing, like, the good things he does from a technical
standpoint. But it's him using his technical know-how to bring this together.
Yeah, and where it all comes down, so I mean, it was a great experience, but it was something that, you know, you had to go to the theater to really get all of those elements.
Right, right.
And that's okay. Where I feel that, you know, you can see it. I think it's still worth it when they release it, you know,
right,
on home, but you're not going to get that same feel.
Interesting. Okay, well, I wish I'd be able to see it, but...
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned Mary Poppins, which I didn't get to see, but my wife did. She loved it. And then I've been very sick, so I haven't been able to get out there again because she wants to see it a second time. And what else did you see over this last few weeks?
Okay, I saw a few films. I'll just run through quickly. I saw Assassination Nation, which we will talk about later after you've seen it.
Yeah, it's not available for me to see right now.
Yeah, so I don't want to talk about it yet. It's really worth talking about. I saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. I think it's a great family film. The art style is fantastic. It does not look like every other CGI animated movie.
That interests me.
Yeah, it looks like a comic book. Like, the backgrounds have the little dots and stuff.
Hmm.
The way things are... put out of focus is by shifting the image slightly instead of having it blurry. It does not look at all like any other 3D CGI animation movie. Great art style. Yes, I saw Mary Poppins. We can talk about that later. I saw The Predator.
Good old Shane Black is back.
Oh, it is. And we'll talk about that after you see it. But it is a Shane Black movie through and through. And by that, I mean, it's just a lot of the characters hanging out talking.
Is it? I mean, you know, obviously you saw it on your home theater there.
Yeah.
Is it worth my time to see when it comes available to me?
Are you a Shane Black completionist?
I'm trying to think, but I may have seen. I've certainly seen every film he's directed up to now.
Okay, then you should see it.
I did like the Nice Guys.
Yeah, okay. The Predator is a lot like the Nice Guys.
It's a Predator version of the Nice Guys.
It is not a Predator movie. It is a Shane Black movie.
Does Russell Crowe make a cameo?
No. Okay. Let's see. I saw Mission Impossible Fallout.
And
fantastic.
You know, my favorite action movie of the year, and if I was able to put the top 10 together, it would probably make the top 10.
Yeah. The way Christopher McGuire choreographs action is so clear-minded, so you really have a sense of where you're located in the action. And so much of the movie is real. Yes, there's tons of CGI, but the CGI blends in really well.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher McQuarrie.
Oh, it's McQuarrie. Okay.
Yes. But, you know, yeah, what you're saying is CGI, when it's complementing real action.
Yes.
And live stuff and not like just the whole shebang kind of farmed out and none of this is real. That's when CGI is really effective.
Exactly. And in Mission Impossible, the CGI in Mission Impossible is good enough that you don't notice it.
Exactly. It certainly doesn't detract from the film.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I know that you got to see it on your new sort of big screen experience. I saw it in a huge, giant theater. And, I mean, those action scenes, edge of your seat.
Yeah, great stuff. Really, yeah, great action filmmaking.
I mean, my sons, that helicopter chase at the end, I mean, you just have never seen anything like it. Because you watch it and you're like, I can't believe they're doing this.
Yeah, no, the helicopter chase. And that's intercut with defusing two bombs. I think one of the great bomb defusal scenes in cinema history, actually.
There you have it, folks.
Yep. Let's see. What else did I saw the Hunger Games Catching Fire. Never saw that before.
Wait, is that the second one?
It's the second one.
Ugh. That one's not too bad, even though it's really just a rehash of the first movie.
Yeah.
But stop there, man. Those last two films. Oh,
really?
Oh, well, because it was basically... one story, one movie that they just spread out into two. And, you know, sometimes you really have to appreciate a screen adaption for what they cut out, because when you get these two-parters and they leave everything in, it's just, it's a slog. And there's literally one movie there that is spread over two films, and lose a lot of focus, and you don't really give a crap at the end.
Yeah.
I really didn't. It really lost me.
I'm gonna watch it because my daughter just read the books.
Oh, so now she wants to see.
She wants to see the movie, so that's why I'm watching them. Yeah.
Look out when she starts reading Twilight.
She hates Twilight.
Oh, good, because, you mean, after that first movie, which isn't that great, but it's okay. At least it's done with some style.
Yeah, it's watchable. Okay, so what else did I see? I saw Bird Box. We talked about that. I saw Quiet Place. We talked about that.
All right, well, before, because I know there's one movie that you may have seen, but let's hold that for a second so I can run down a couple that I saw.
Okay. There's another one that I didn't mention yet, but we will talk about at some point. The Meg.
Oh, okay. We're going to talk about that. Not in this show, because there's not enough time. But I saw some stuff, but the one movie that I will mention very briefly, I know you haven't seen it, but it's a shout out for people who can catch it in the theater, is The Favorite.
Yes, I want to see The Favorite, yeah.
Yorgos Lanthimos, and we'll see, you know, if it grabs some Oscar consideration in a few weeks, but I did have a couple of issues. I don't think he stuck the landing.
Okay.
In the end of the film, I think there was some room there to make that film just a little bit juicier and better at the end. However, you know, very few films today will dare to do some of the stuff that he does in this film, especially from the cinematography standpoint.
Oh, interesting.
It's all shot. It's on film, by the way, and it's shot with natural light.
Oh, cool.
So there's some comparisons being made to sort of Barry Lyndon.
Right.
However, maybe with a natural light, that's kind of where it stops, because what he's very focused on, every single shot in the film is shot with a wide angle lens.
Oh, no kidding.
And I think what people will recognize are these very strange fisheye lens shots that he uses, which... It's not just, you know, not that you don't see that in a film even. He uses it frequently and pans with it and does all sorts of strange things with it. But regardless, take away the fisheye, every other shot in the film is shot clearly with a wide-angle lens because of the compositions and the way the close-ups look. And what he's trying to do is create this claustrophobic experience of what this particular palace entails, and just how little space there is inside this palace. And I think what that does is just adds another element to what's going on with the screenplay. You have to be in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing in order to pull it off.
So I haven't seen The Lobster.
You never saw The Lobster?
I haven't seen The Lobster, but Killing of a Sacred Deer. Very similar thing. A lot of those wide angle, a lot of fisheye. And doing interesting camera movement with fisheye and framing. Yeah, very similar kind of thing to what you're talking about with The Favorite.
I haven't seen Killing of a Sacred Deer, but it's one that, you know, you keep mentioning. So I'm going to watch it. And I don't know what, hopefully soon.
Well, I'll watch The Lobster and then...
And then we'll have a Yorgos Fest.
Yes. Somehow we're going to have to fit Dogtooth in there.
Okay. So later this year, we'll have a whole Yorgos episode.
Yeah, a whole wide-angle episode.
I want to talk about a film that is now streaming on Amazon Prime and also Hulu, if you don't have one or you have the other.
Hereditary is the movie we're talking about. It's getting a lot of notice. A lot of people are talking about it, largely because of Toni Collette's performance, which kind of anchors the whole movie. This is a movie about a family that suffers some tragedy, is grieving, and some supernatural elements come into play as the family sort of falls apart. Well, it's by the end, it's full on supernatural. But I guess what I was getting at is that it's a slow burn on the supernatural stuff.
You know, horror films or horror sort of supernatural thrillers is also not my favorite genre. But why I was drawn to see Hereditary is it seems like it's one of those polarizing films. There was a disconnect between a lot of critics who loved it,
right,
and then audiences that I think when it got into theaters gave it a terrible cinema score.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Audiences did not like it. And already that intrigues me. Because, you know, why is it that people flock to these Blumhouse movies like There's No Tomorrow?
Right.
These PG-13 quick scare movies. They get like 30, 40 million in a weekend. But then you get a film like this. Critics are praising it. Says it's maybe a step up on your horror genre.
Yeah.
And people try to avoid it like the plague.
It's so weird. Yeah. I mean, it's... I had a lot of problems with it, but it is a step up from your average horror film. I'll give it that.
Yeah, I mean, so how do we review a film like this where it's not our favorite genre, right? You almost feel like I'm bringing an expert who loves these kind of films to get their take.
I mean, I do. Look, I like horror films a lot. The supernatural thing is not usually the most scary to me. I ghost stories don't really engage me that much. But I do like horror films, and I do like, I'll mention Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is similar in the terms of a family kind of being torn apart by grief and the supernatural. This movie makes what I consider a mistake about 20 minutes in that it never recovered from for me.
Is this a big spoiler?
Sure. Why should I?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the part that like really threw me was at the 30-minute mark.
Okay, I may be off on my minutes.
Okay.
Are we talking about the accident?
Yeah.
The accident was really poorly thought out. It's poorly executed. Until immediately after the accident, it's really well executed, which is that it just focuses on this character's face in the aftermath. Just a close-up on his face. Then the next morning after the accident, we're again close-up on his face. And we hear Toni Collette's response to the accident off-screen.
I thought it was fantastic.
Fantastic moment. Really powerful emotional moment that the movie then completely sabotages.
Well, I want to take a step back. All right. I think we, you know, I actually, I mean, you can't say you love that moment. I thought it was very disturbing. As a matter of fact, this whole part, it was so disturbing that a large part of me said, do I want to continue watching this movie? And so I thought from that point, right, if it's that disturbing, it's effective. But I got to take a step back.
I didn't find it disturbing. I found it silly.
Oh, I found it disturbing.
Okay, well.
You know. But, you know, I have a heart. No, I'm just kidding.
Right. Well,
so, wait. But listen, but we're going to take a step back because I had some problems that might even lead to when we're talking about like the way things are handled.
Yeah.
Here are some problems. And we touched about on this earlier in our talk when we were getting into Bird Box is that this film, it was shot in a weird, it was actually a weird aspect ratio. It's 2:1.
Yes.
2:1, which is not your standard film aspect ratio at all. And it's shot on digital, and I even read, because like, you know, sometimes when you're seeing things, you look them up afterwards just to see if I was right on my assumptions, and all the interiors of the house were shot on a soundstage.
Yes.
And because of this very, I mean, the guy, I think he thinks he's Kubrick.
Right.
If he was going to do that, he should have shot 185, but, or even 166 might have been a better choice.
Yeah, the 2:1 in a house is, okay.
That's the thing is, if he's trying to create this claustrophobia,
yeah,
I think that, again, I have this gripe about directors shooting these aspect ratios for no reason. And there's these very mechanical, cool, almost computerized shots that are ridiculous, and they take me out of the film. And the movie, I think it's part of his point because Toni Collette, it seems like what she does for a living is she's an artist who builds these very intricate little models of houses.
Right.
And so,
of course, she has no tools and never does any building. She just arranges things in them.
The film looks like it's on a set. And it doesn't have that nice sort of creepy film. Like, I'd love to see a low budget version of this that shot on film, like 16 millimeter, just kind of. It gives it that little edginess.
Yes, that edginess. But also, I got to go back to this accident.
Wait a minute. Time out.
Okay.
I will let you get back to it. I'm going to let you finish here, buddy.
Okay.
But the music of this movie really bothered me.
Okay.
I thought it was really bad.
Okay.
And
here's,
then it ruined the atmosphere.
Not just the music. This was my initial thing with this movie in the first few minutes was the sound design. Not just the music, but the sound design. And I guess, you know, some of this is score, but on normal scenes, it layers this sound underneath, this sort of a bass tone heartbeat, like...
Yeah, and you know what? You have now, you know, disclosure, you just set up yourself a home system, right?
Yes, where I can hear that kind of stuff coming through the subwoofer.
Right, and so, you know, I don't. I just have it through my TV thing, and you don't really hear that stuff. Plus, I've also been sick, so, like, my hearing's been really off. But, you know, a lot of times, the mixes they do for streaming, etc., they're different even than the theatrical mixes.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, this tone is there whether you're really paying attention to it or not.
And you're now focused on saying it means something and that it's annoying because why else would they do it?
It's annoying because it's creating tension in a scene artificially, as opposed to letting the actors create the tension. You know, I'm talking about one scene early on, which is just the parents talking. It's just a normal scene.
First movie, right? So you have to give, like, maybe some credit to the fact that I think the film is successful in a lot of other areas, especially for a debut film.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, show some restraint.
And this film does not show any restraint.
Yeah, it's just, you know what? It's almost like it's too odd for its own good. And
yeah.
Yet it doesn't spend enough time maybe just giving you some basic facts. It's
exactly.
He's so busy on not wanting to reveal certain things that I think he reveals them almost too late.
They're revealed too late, but also, like, one of the big reveals just comes in somebody looking at some books, right? It's like, yeah, the least dramatic way you could reveal this is to have somebody read it in a book.
And apparently, from what I've read, there was a lot cut out that was shot. I felt that after a big tragic event that happened, why the son isn't in psychotherapy? Or
yes,
even put in a home for a while. That just didn't make sense. You know what I mean? Like, there was stuff that, again, it all kind of, the puzzle gets put together at the end. And I personally loved where he went with the very ending. But because of the ending, I was
not at all surprised by the ending.
Well, I didn't say I was surprised. I just loved the fact that I feel like a lot of films don't go there.
Wouldn't go all the way, right.
But, and he went all the way. So I like that.
But the thing is, I was talking earlier about the reveal in the book. She's reading the book and it's revealed.
Yeah.
The entire ending is revealed in the book. And to me, that was too big a reveal. And so, but it's like, okay, here's what the next 20 minutes of the movie is going to be.
Well, but see, I think this is where he had some problems, is because if you build those plot points out throughout the film, people are figuring it out much faster.
Yeah.
And because he didn't want people to figure out the end of the story, he ends up putting it all to the end and everything happens so fast they don't have time to think.
Exactly.
And it makes the rest of the film a little bit more implausible because the characters act and behave in ways that in normal situations they would not.
Exactly. And that undermines for me, or sabotages, the emotional weight of the film that, like, Toni Collette's performance brings to it.
If this film was just a bag of crap, I don't think it'd be worth talking about.
No, it wouldn't be.
But there's something here that I think that it's going to have a little staying power. I think people are still going to find it, be talking about it. It's going to get entered into that realm of, oh man, Hereditary, that was awesome. Just because you and I didn't, like, love it.
I don't know. We'll see. Time will tell.
There's a very few horror movies that I, like, actually think hook, line, sinker were great. You know, like Babadook. I love the Babadook.
If I was, I think a film you have not seen, and Hereditary reminded me of it in ways I can't really give away. They're completely different kinds of movies. So another movie I would put in this category, and maybe I'm giving too much away, is The Wicker Man.
Oh, it's one of my favorite movies.
Right. Okay. So,
but The Wicker Man, every step of the way. Now, that movie is so perfectly constructed.
Yes.
Oh, wait, full disclosure. We're not talking
about the Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage. We're talking
about
the Robin Hardy 1973 classic.
Yes. Okay. So, the other film I was thinking of in terms of Hereditary, very, very different, But in terms of the direction and the slow feed and how it, anyhow, the film I'm thinking of is Kill List by Ben Wheatley.
You just love that guy. I do not dig his movies, man.
No, neither do I. Well, I have problems with a lot of his movies, but Kill List, I really like.
No, maybe I'll check that out. I hated Free Fire. I thought that was a bag of crap.
Free Fire is not good.
You liked it.
No, I just wanted you to watch it.
Come on now. You only didn't like it after I told you it was horrible. And then you're like, oh, geez, maybe it wasn't that good. It was hard. It could have been amazing.
It could have been amazing. Yeah.
It was
here's
horrible.
The thing.
There's a bottle film for
I've seen every Ben Wheatley movie, and I have faults with all of them. Did you ever see High Rise?
Nope.
No. Okay.
And I did sort of want that. But you know what? Here's the thing, though. I think, and I'll give him this much. I think he's one of those directors that one day he's going to take all the good things he does and he's going to put it together and he's going to make that one film that could change everything for him. And I think that's like, you know, you have the Coen brothers, right? They started the career. People had different issues. They had the same types of problems. But you knew they were onto something. And then, boom, they came up with Fargo.
Yes. That's how I feel about Ben Wheatley is he's all over the place right now. But he also does really experimental stuff. You know, he'll shoot a movie on no money whatsoever in 2 weeks. Just
like a field in England.
Like a field in England. Exactly. Yeah. Just as an experiment. And there aren't a lot of directors who are doing that kind of thing these days.
Thank God. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I just think he's interesting. My favorite movie of his is Kill List.
All right. I'll look for it.
And... yeah, it's worth checking out, I think. Okay, a few more things on Hereditary. The last act of this movie, to me, was a kitchen sink. It was just, let's throw in every horror trope we can think of and see what sticks. And it just got silly to me. It wasn't scary at that point because it was like, let's have somebody light on fire. Let's have things move around. Let's have somebody beheaded. Let's have, you know, it was like one horror trope after another, just all thrown in there to see what sticks.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, this is my particular problem with the horror genre. Sooner or later, it comes down to the tropes. And, you know, there's only, I could put a hand how many horror movies in the last 10 years that I liked. And I really thought It Follows was taking a formula and doing something new with it.
Yeah.
And I think that The Babadook is very, very successful and kind of did its own thing. And then that's it.
Okay, I'm really curious to hear what you think of Kill List.
All right, well, now I'm going to have to go dig up the old Kill List.
You're going to have to dig up. You may hate it, but I think it's worth talking about.
I'm probably going to. I really don't like this guy, but I'll check it out because that's what, you know, you tell me to see things, I see them. I tell you to see things, you might see them.
Yeah, I mean, let me put it this way. The only reason I got into watching Ben Wheatley movies at all is because I liked Kill List.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you lost a bet.
No. But, you know, Kill List was also something I came into totally blind. I just, like...
blind boxed?
Bird box. No, I mean, I had no hype on Kill List. I just came. I just saw it and clicked on it and watched it.
If you look at Kill List, you will kill yourself.
Yes.
Don't get added to the Kill List.
Well, wait, what other Ben Wheatley movies have you seen that you really don't like?
Field in England is one of them.
Well, that movie is just awful.
Well, I mean, he actually has made all sorts of weird movies. Most of them you can't even see. They're like hidden out there. I'm telling you, you told me to see this Free Fire and I was all excited because I thought the preview looked great.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was, you know, it was a bottle movie.
Yeah.
And it had that awful digital cinema look, and I was like, oh, if it had just been like shot on film, that
if it had just been shot on film, yeah.
And I felt like it was one of those things that actors that are not like A-list, they sign on because they get to like chew up the scenery,
right?
Or they think they're chewing up the scenery, and he didn't have the dialogue chops to like carry it off. I'd seen the movie 1,000 times before. I don't know. I just felt like it was a big bag of cliches, and it never did anything new. Hated it. Hated it. Hated it. Never but thought wait, I'd ever talk about it.
But, is that the yeah. only one of his movies you've seen?
Enfield of Innocence? Well, what do I have to after that? It's really hard to get me to go see a movie.
Okay, no, I got it. Yeah.
I'm choking you up with my reality. I know. But listen.
No, A Field in England is terrible. I can't recommend it to anyone. It should not be watched ever by anyone. Not even Ben Wheatley completionist should see it.
See, you're not really selling this guy. But...
But like you said, I think he's doing something interesting. He hasn't quite hit on it yet. He hasn't quite made his masterpiece, but he does have a voice. He's doing something interesting. His wife writes all the movies. It's her dialogue chops that you're
picking on. Oh, so we're blaming her.
Yeah.
Okay. well there, kids, you know, we're close to the end. Hey, you know, but before we go, it's 2019 and, it's year of Blade Runner.
It is the year of Blade Runner.
Get your flying car out.
Yep. And not just Blade Runner.
There are a few other, 2019 era films, right?
Yeah. That are science fiction films set in 2019. Akira. I don't know if have you ever seen
anime?
The anime, yep.
Anime, wouldn't I tell you? Anime and me, we're not friends.
And Blade Runner, of course, we mentioned, and I, and The Running Man.
Oh yes, The Running Man.
Yes, and I think it's fascinating that The Running Man and Blade Runner, because in many ways, I think we've ended up with The Running Man future, not the Blade Runner future.
Yeah, the Blade Runner future is maybe coming, but yeah, the Running Man future is certainly here.
Yeah, the Running Man future is certainly here. Another film from the set in 2019 is Daybreaker.
Oh, I like Daybreaker.
Yeah, it's a great vampire movie that's, I think, sort of political and allegorical in a lot of ways.
There's one that, like, you know, kind of went out of the box with its story. I like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a new sort of twist on the whole vampire thing. Okay, and then another sci-fi film set in 2019, Michael Bay's The Island.
Ooh, you know, I had a really interesting date in summer of 2005 where I was forced to see The Island with this... girl I was dating, and I was getting to meet her friends for the first time, and these friends showed up really late, and even though we had all the tickets, we had, like, I kept on saying, well, can't some of us go inside to get seats? No, we gotta wait for this guy. And this guy was a real jackass, right, who finally showed up. So we get
in
there.
Wait, I thought you were on a date. How many people are here?
Yeah, well, I was meeting all her friends.
Oh, right? Okay.
So we had, again, we had tickets in advance. This was in Boston, and, and so we had to wait, even though I was like, but we could get seats and then just two people wait. But no. So we had to wait for this guy. We ended up, the whole theater was packed and we had to sit in the front row.
Oh.
And I was livid because there was no excuse for it. We could have all been in the middle of the theater, right? So not only did I not really like her friends, we didn't last beyond the summer, but. You know, I had to see The Island right there in the front row. And believe me, it's hard enough to sit through that film, but to sit there in the front row of it, you'll never forget it.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay.
And you know my hatred of Michael Bay and his films.
Well, and this is, you know, if you were going to look at
all... It's one of his better movies.
It's one of his better movies, yeah. Yeah, it's actually one of his better movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, and again, it's, I don't know if it's been credited, it's essentially a ripoff of Logan's Run.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if it was credited as a remake, but I mean, if it wasn't, somebody ought to be getting a lawsuit going. it's like a ripoff with a few differences.
Yes.
It's sort of like Let Me In, or what's that movie, the British dystopian, where they have to sell their body, they're all... clones.
Oh.
I love that movie. I think it's good.
Yes, and I'm blanking on it now.
I don't know. It's was written by Alex Garland. Well, not the screenplay was. The director of Annihilation, which we'll talk about in a future episode. But anyways, we're really... I don't know what we're supposed to say about these 2019 movies
I was just going to say, it's interesting that, you know, that these movies sort of just happened to fall in the same year, that this was kind of a popular year for sci-fi movies.
Well, you know, what's funny is that 1982, when Blade Runner came out, I actually saw it in the theater with my dad. And I remember thinking 2019, wow, I'll be like 49 years old, and that's way off. I wonder what it'll be like then. Maybe it'll be like this. It's just so funny is that in 1982, 2019 just felt
so far away. Yeah.
Yeah, and now here it is. It's here.
Yeah, and Akira and The Running Man are also from the 80s.
Yes, and I saw Running Man in the theater as well.
Yeah,
and Akira,
so
of course, as I said, I did not see that movie.
But yeah, I just think it's interesting. I haven't done any research to see a film set in 2020, but I think there's something about the number that screenwriters like to pick, 2019.
I know there's a meme going out there about Zardoz, but that's actually not 2019. Somebody got that wrong.
Yes.
But it was a great excuse to have the meme for Zardoz. But hey, it's getting late, kids.
Okay.
And we need to put the episode to bed.
Let's put the episode to bed.
Don't worry. It's just the beginning of the year, and we're going to be back with lots more episodes. We have now an Instagram account, by the by.
Yeah, check us out on Instagram.
Yeah, Jim and Teal on Instagram. And we also, feedback at jimandteal.com.
Great. We'll see you next time.
All right, everybody, and goodbye.
Goes and flows of angel hair. And ice cream castles in the air, and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I really don't know clouds.